Boy, it's nice to see this many people here. It's really good to be able to talk about food and holding food. And I was real glad when there was this opportunity when Barry asked me, because I had thought about doing it earlier in the summer, too. So initially, we'd like to have some participation, too. And I think that food is a really exciting topic, and it's really a fun topic. I often use nutrition analogies and food analogies in other aspects of my life, in my spiritual life or my emotional or psychological life. I sometimes can see where I'm kind of malnourished and where my diet is lacking, and I can use real concrete examples from my regular physical diet of the food that I eat as analogies to other aspects of my life. So for me, nutrition has kind of become something that's pretty holistic and something that I think affects other areas of my life psychologically as well as physically, as well as my environment. So kind of to begin, we'd like to share some scriptures about what is written about food and what kind of blessings food has been and the way God has bestowed us with food and the wealth and abundance of food.
And also, we're both cooks here at mm-hmm. Holden. Sharon Gonzalez, I'm Dick Wernemeyer. One that I found that I really liked is in Deuteronomy 8 and 7 to 10. For the Lord your God is bringing you into a good land, a land of brooks of water, of fountains and springs, flowing forth in valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley, of vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of olive oil and honey, a land where you shall eat food without scarcity, in which you shall not lack anything, a land whose stones are iron and out of whose hills you can dig copper. When you have eaten and are satisfied, you shall bless the Lord your God for the good land which he has given you. I really think that's pretty true, especially for here in this country. We have like an abundance of gifts that we're given from the land. So we're pretty much not lacking for anything, are we?
And I think there's a lot of references in the Old Testament that refer to the abundance of food and that the blessing that God has given man is to work heartily and enjoy one's labor and eat healthily. So I think that there's a lot of scriptures. We tried to look for various aspects of scriptures that talked about food or eating in different contexts. So it's real good to begin with that. The next thing that I'd like to begin with is maybe just a little bit of participation from you also, and I'd like to throw out a couple questions. First of all, I don't know, maybe what interested you to coming to the session, or how do you find Holden's food? Do you find it real different? Is it real different from your normal diet? And if any of you have changed your diets in your life, you know, in the recent past or further in the past, you know, what motivated you to changing your diet or to going toward different foods? Anybody that would like to share any comments?
Well, I've been learning to cook that you should use a lot more fiber. Uh-huh. And so we use mostly all dark bread. Mm-hmm. And our fruits, we eat the peelings and mm-hmm. various things like that.
Yeah. Yeah, the processed stuff now has kind of gone away from the fiber. So it is a really important mm-hmm. thing.
Anyone else?
Well, I'd hate to continue eating as much as I do here back home without the ability to compensate for it by hiking it off.
Do some of you find you might have already gained weight since you've been here or no? A little bit?
Yes.
Is the style... Pardon me?
How can you miss?
Uh-huh. Well, that's good.
Well...
Yes.
I think I lost 5 pounds.
You lost 5 pounds,
but
good.
That's all.
Well, we'll work on it. There's other people who also come and say that they lose weight, and there's a lot of, this is just kind of off the subject, but I would just like to add that as far as Holden style food goes, there's a lot of ways that in the diet that we eat, even if people eat a lot of quantity, it's not the kind of food that has real heavy concentrations of fat or oils in it. In the kinds of ways that a lot of processed food that we eat in other aspects of our diet or in fast food chains or in other you know, ways when we're at home that increase the fat content and the the caloric intake of our food that we don't always realize. And at Holden here, using pretty much whole foods, you really, when you move away from the processed foods and the foods that are really overly kind of have a lot of ingredients that we don't always know are in them, you can move to a much cleaner diet, which is what I call a cleaner diet. It's easy for your body to digest, it's easy for your body to process, and the calories are actually burned up in a way that is metabolized more quickly and more efficiently. And so many times people have actually come here and they've lost a little bit of weight even though they've eaten a pretty good quantity of food. But that's not everybody. You know, other people's bodies, it's the opposite.
Good mention. I quit last week. I quit coffee, cold turkey.
Oh, that's interesting.
That affected my well-being quite a bit.
All right. Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot of things I think that contribute to the change in diet here at Holden and in the United States for the past 10 or 15 years, and I can't begin to talk about all that or even claim that I know all the ways to approach it. But I think that looking at food stewardship is real important for all of us. I have found it to be real important in my own life after studying pretty much in college about the world hunger situation. And I think that food stewardship, the main reason why we should question why are we looking at dietary changes, or why are we, you know, eating less meat, or why are we changing our diet, is because of the stewardship of the food. The reality is that we do have a world hunger situation, and there are people on this planet that we know about and that we can hear about and read about that do not even have enough for daily sustenance. And why is that? What has caused that situation? Trying to answer those kind of questions, trying to answer questions of the economics of food and why has food become so much more expensive compared to, you know, a long time ago when you could buy a lot more food from the percentage of your budget than maybe you can now, and why has food changed so drastically? I mean, what is our stewardship of our food that we are called to question? And so I think that just the basic realities of the hunger problem in the world, the fact that people are still starving, and the fact that certain areas and certain countries still have an abundance, and we live with luxury and plenty, and even our waste could feed poor countries. You know, what does that all say about our stewardship of food? So I think there's a real need to question it. There's a lot of different ways that we can look at questioning it. And please, you know, stop me whenever I start rambling. I think that there's like four different categories that I really like to emphasize when we look at food and we question food stewardship. The first is nutritional questions. Why do we, you know, what is the change nutritionally in our bodies? What is the change? Are we getting enough proteins? All the kind of things we have to question when we look at the nutritional aspect of dietary change. I think there's ethical reasons why people change their diet. And most recently, in the past, I would say 5 to 10 years, there's been a lot of ethical questions about the violence done to animals, about the ethics of the land use, and a lot of ethical questions around diet. The third category would be environmental questions. That even more specifically, land use, and how are we using resources? Why are there so many pesticides being used, and all the chemicals we use to preserve food and to process it, and how those are affecting our environment and then in turn affecting our bodies? So environmental questions, and other people definitely emphasize the economic and international imbalance that the food situation is creating. So I think that there's People have taken many different approaches, and there's even others, but I kind of break it down to these basic four of the nutritional, the ethical, the environmental, and the international economic consequences of food and of our own food stewardship here in this country. So there's a lot of things that we could talk about in each of these categories, but I've tried to summarize each of the four of them and give a brief synopsis of some of the things that are kind of main points to look at and to observe. And then after that, we can actually talk about maybe a few more scriptures about what the Bible says about food, or we will include them in each of these four categories and what to do, and sort of, you know, how Holden as a community is addressing any of these four aspects. So, and if you have any questions at any time or you have any observations, please, you share them. And I, even though myself I'm a vegetarian, I'm not a real strict vegetarian, and I you know, certainly when I go home, I certainly eat meat with my family or try to appreciate their diet. And I think that it's a question that just we're all on different ends of the spectrum, and our bodies require different things. We do each have individual bodily needs and differences. And then just our own approach and our own look at food is different. And I think we all need to accommodate that in each other and to just, you know, try to be respectful as we try to understand each other's different approaches. So if some of the things that I say tonight seem like I'm either pro-vegetarianism or anti-meat eaters, please don't take offense, because I really am not trying to present it that way. But I think it's all involved in the question of food stewardship and why we look at diet and dietary changes. So nutritionally, of course, there's a lot of reasons when people start to decrease their food intake or eat lower on the food chain, they notice nutritional differences. So before we go into actual some of the differences that they may notice, I'd like to explain a little bit more what eating lower on the food chain is, and if anyone has any observations to complement that, please share them. I have a chart here, and this would start out with some basic facts that I got out of three of my favorite cookbooks. The first one, well, two of my favorite cookbooks, and then I found a third resource. First one is Diet for a Small Planet by Frances Moore LePay. Many of you might have heard about it or read it. It's real good. Frances Moore LePay in the early 70s started questioning the ethics of our diet in this country and our food production system and the ethics of it and the health aspects of it and everything. She did a real thorough investigation of it, her and her husband, and they've come up with this recipe book. It has good recipes, and it also has the theory behind the changes of their philosophy and a certain approach to vegetarianism. And then this other book that I like a lot is Laurel's Kitchen. And Laurel's Kitchen is a favorite of mine. This woman also, Laurel, has done a lot of investigating on simpler foods, eating more whole foods, and moving away from a meat diet, merely for reasons of better health and better economics, both individually, community-wise, and internationally. So those are two really good resources. And then this third one, we just found this summer, and this was by some people that came up to Holden for the summer to visit, and it's called the Piecemeal Diet. And it's called, the subtitle is A Seduction into Cruelty-Free Living. And these people, it's real interesting when I was reading this book, when she gave it to me, because it's totally a vegetarian cookbook based on a cruelty-free approach to animals, or, you know, no violence to animals. And I will share some things that she's written in this book. And this is the first vegetarian cookbook I've seen written exclusively from that point of view, of really thinking that the kind of food production system we have in this country is doing violence to animals, and it's very unjust for us to be doing that to other fellow creatures. So that's interesting perspective too. Some of these things are controversial, and they can be argued in a lot of different ways. I think that just presenting the information and making it available is important. So if we look at the food chain, can everybody see this sort of room?
It's actually better if you leave it right under the light.
Under the light. Is that better? Okay. So, if we look at the food chain, we can go up from the bottom up to humans. That's why we talk about eating lower on the food chain. We basically can look at plants, legumes, beans, and grains as being produced on acreage of farms. These, of course, can be consumed directly by humans, but many times with our food production system here in America, these things, barley, oats, millet, grain, certain wheat, other grains, are fed to chicken, poultry, and fish. And then we, in turn, consume the chicken or the poultry. They also are fed to pigs and lambs, which are even a more complex being on the food chain and require even more of these things to feed the pig and pigs and lambs, which then in turn humans consume. And the beef cattle are even higher, because they even require more of these things to produce enough pounds of beef in order to feed humans a normal pound of meat. And I have some statistics over here. The pounds of soy and grains that it takes to get 1 pound of meat would be 3 to 4 pounds of soy product, either soybeans or soy grits or something, or grains. And mostly, like I said, it's barley, oats, and
and corn, thank you. Barley, oats, and corn are the three main grains that they feed to animals. So it takes 3 to 4 pounds of that to feed chicken, poultry, or fish to produce 1 pound of meat. It takes 6 pounds of these grains and soy products to produce 1 pound of pig or lamb. And it takes 16 pounds of soy grains or barley, corn, or oats to feed beef cattle to get 1 pound of meat to serve human beings. And 1 pound of meat then would serve about, we could estimate, maybe 3 human beings at a third of a pound apiece. So here we're having 3 pounds of three human beings fed on a process that takes 16 pounds of grain. And if these same human beings just consumed the 16 pounds of grain, we could feed about 25 people with the same 16 pounds of grain, okay, to feed this many people. So the same amount of grain could feed, you know, how many more, 8 times more people approximately. So when we talk about eating lower on the food chain, first of all, we talk about more of a direct link between humans and the consumption of food that is produced on acreage. So, and if I'm going kind of faster, it sounds a little unclear, please stop me and I'll try to re-explain better. So if we look at 1 acre of food production, grains produce 5 times more protein than would be produced for meat production. So when animals and beef cattle are allowed to graze on an acre of land, they produce 5 times less the amount of protein than if that same land was used exclusively for grains that would be consumed by humans. If that same acre was used to produce beans or legumes, you would have 10 times more protein produced by that acre than for meat production. And if you had plants, especially spinach, I was real surprised this today when I found out in Diet for a Small Planet that spinach, an acre of spinach can produce 26 times more protein than for an acre of beef production. But most other plants will just say 15 times more. Yes?
I just want to, we have hillsides where you can't plant corn and soybeans and all this. I just want to throw that out to cattle and lamb are capable of
sure. Burning
cellulose that we can't digest.
Yes, exactly.
That's true, and the beef that are raised on grazed land they have a lot more protein content and they're leaner and there's less fat in the meat in animals that are grazed versus animals that are standing in a feedlot eating corn.
And can you share that one about people in China or India? What was that one you mean about? That one about
when they graze? Americans using approximately 2,000 pounds of grain per year per person. And all but 150 of those are consumed indirectly in meat and milk and eggs and alcoholic beverages. And in Asia, people eat less than 400 pounds, and those are directly as rice or wheat.
That they directly consume.
Yeah, and in Europe, it's approximately 1,000 pounds of grain per year per person.
But don't we have more grain and stuff in this country now? It's coming out of our ears if we could. Why don't we use it then?
Right.
Our problem has been surpluses all along.
Sure.
Not has seen fit to give us the best land, the best weather, the best know-how, the best machinery, the best seed. You put that all together and we can raise much more than, one-fourth of our farm is laying idle.
Okay.
Think of all the grain that could have been. I think of that when I go out there and work that idle acre. How many people could eat the food that I'm destroying here?
Right, right.
We destroyed wheat this year that went 50 bushels an acre. Okay. We went out and destroyed it.
Now, see, that question is real complex to answer with just one sentence, but that is part of the problem of our whole food production system in this country. The way that we contribute to a system that is pretty far exaggerated from most of the other parts of the world. Yes, we can produce so much more, but by the same token, there's not the means to actually get that out to other countries, or we also don't prioritize the means. I found a statistic today too that I was going to, or a quote from the same book that I was going to share under the international and economic
dilemmas and questions, and that is that actually we concentrate our small and shrinking aid budget onto military, for military and political purposes. So even the aid budget and the priorities that our government does set for helping other countries, it is not allocated by giving food, and that is not seen as a priority, food aid, and better, more appropriate direct kinds of aid, which would of course be agricultural aid, even better than giving, you know, poor countries our food. It's better to give them agricultural assistance to help them improve their own system. But most of our nation's policies, we concentrate a very small percentage of that on agricultural aid and food aid, and we put a lot more of it into military and political assistance, which is much farther removed from their basic human needs. So see, I know it doesn't directly answer the question of what to do with all that surplus grain, but it's part of a system in our country that really needs questioning, because I don't think that we're being proper stewards of the kind of resources.
It's a distribution problem, not a production problem.
Well, maybe not production for us.
If we would take 1% of what it costs us to go to the moon, or 1% of what it costs us to keep our military going, and just use that 1% to spread food around the country, we could eliminate this problem.
Yes, we very well could.
And it wouldn't hurt the moon project, it wouldn't hurt the army to sacrifice 1%. Mm-hmm. What's 1% of $1 trillion?
Right. And that's why,
I think it's $100 million, if I've not got my figures right.
But that ties into all the economic complexities of it, because actually, that's what agencies like Bread for the World try to do. They try to work on domestic and international hunger, and they try to address injustices like that. But see, the farmers, and I'm certainly not trying to blame the farmers, but the whole economics is that many times the farmers get more profit if they just go ahead and destroy that grain. And they don't go through the channels of trying to get it distributed and trying to go through charity organizations or church groups or nonprofit agencies, because all that takes way too long, and it's just not for their, it's not to their benefit to do that. Now, I'm not saying all farmers are that way, but I know even of the farmers that especially large production farmers, it's much more in their interest to just accept whatever policy the government is dictating and allow, you know, themselves to either be reimbursed or allow the government to just give them some kind of compensation, which is much easier. And our government also is making that kind of priority and making that kind of decision, and without us questioning that and challenging that and supporting agencies like Bread for the World, which try to actually lobby for the change in domestic hunger problems, the whole system is still contributing to the grain being destroyed rather than being channeled into feeding hungry people. And a lot of it is economics. I'm just kind of trying to respond to
that kind of gets away from what you're talking about here.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We can continue this discussion in a little bit. The other aspect of the food chain, then, if I could just finish this part, is that there's also increased waste as we go up the food chain, because there's about 40% protein that can be consumed from the lower rung of the food chain directly by humans. So we can use about 40% of that, and the rest goes directly to waste. Either by the process of shucking some of the outer husks of the grain off, and then when it comes into our body and we digest it, there is about half waste. But to feed that to chicken, poultry, or fish, there is the same waste that comes from this group not being able to consume it. And then there's additional waste that we can't use even when we consume the chicken, the poultry, or the fish. And as it goes up again, there's a waste here of the percentage of protein. And there's a waste again here with beef cattle. There's something that was shared in Diet for a Small Planet, just for you, that an example of 140 million tons of grain, soy, corn, barley, and oats being fed to beef cattle, only 20 million tons of that 140 million tons is returned to us as meat. The other 118 million tons out of the 140 is inaccessible for human consumption and is waste. So all that grain, again, 16 pounds of grain that is used to feed the beef cattle, and such a small percentage of that can actually be utilized by our bodies for human consumption, and the rest of it is waste. So there's also a lot of waste as we go up the food chain. So there's a lot of aspects of the food chain that I was trying to bring in here, both the amounts of grain that it takes to feed creatures higher up on the food chain before they get to human consumption, and the amount of waste that is involved in that system.
What do you mean by waste? Could you define that a little bit?
Actual non-consumable parts of the animal. You know, you're taking 16 pounds of soy to fatten up a calf or a cow, but we can only eat a small percentage of that, and the rest of it literally is either fat or bones, or it goes to the other organs that we don't ingest at all. And so the rest of the animal has been fed and nourished, but unfortunately when the cow is slaughtered, all that is wasted. But that same, you know, that still, the 16 pounds of that grain contributed to fattening up that animal. So also, the question on the food chain that Francis Moore LePay in the Diet for a Small Planet addresses a lot is the use of pesticides and hormones and antibiotics and everything that animals are fed, so that even as you go up the food chain, there is an increase of pesticide buildup, of hormonal and all kinds of chemicals that animals are treated with. There is a buildup of all that before it gets to us humans, and that actually by reducing, as you eat higher on the food chain, you consume far more pesticides and cancer-causing chemicals in foods than you would if you ate lower on the food chain. So for a real health reason that a lot of people turn to a more vegetarian diet or less meat consumption, less, not totally eliminating it, but less, is also because of the decreased quantity of pesticides and chemicals that produce cancer and other sicknesses. There will be a decrease of that in their diet, and over a long period of time, of course, you won't get the buildup then. So, I mean, not only are our plants and legumes and beans treated and sprayed with many different kinds of things nonetheless to kill insects, but as animals consume those and that they themselves are given certain chemicals, it continues to build up as we go up the food chain. So by the time we come to us eating a calf or a cow, which itself was fed on pesticidal grains, there's a real buildup of chemicals that we many times don't even know of what kind of chemicals things are treated with. So nutritionally, that's an argument. Nutritionally, again, to stay with that category, that whole foods have fewer or no preservatives. Even moving away from processed foods and real packaged foods, a lot of times those have preservatives in them for shelf storage and shelf life, in an increase in shelf life. And when we eat more whole foods and foods that you can buy in bulk and foods that you can buy which were organically grown, it drastically decreases the amount of pesticides and preservatives that you will be consuming. Other people will also argue that reduced sugar in whole foods and fats reduces the chance for obesity, tooth decay, and diabetes. The individuality of each person's body is taken into consideration, the dietary options will be different, but that people can actually notice a difference in their own body's metabolism and the way that their body works as they maybe move toward a diet that is lower on the food chain. And then meat has considerably higher percentage of cholesterol than plant proteins, and which can cause heart disease and other health hazards. So the amount of cholesterol also, as you go up the food chain, especially in meat and dairy products, is much higher than what you would get in plant foods and grains. Do you have anything to add on the nutritional? Okay, now that's a very inadequate portrayal of the nutritional aspect, because obviously we could go on for hours just talking about the nutritional pros and cons of changing one's diet and the benefits and the effects and, you know, why eat more simply. There's a lot of other nutritional reasons. But those were some of the ones that I saw as the most important in correlation to the food chain, because I think this is a basic concept that one needs to look at on a nutritional level for the reasons of dietary questioning or changing or food stewardship. Then ethical reasons centering around violence to animals, as explained in this piecemeal diet book, was very interesting. This book stands on the argument that vegetarianism is actually more peaceful on many levels. It's actually more peace producing into our society and to us as individuals. And they also question, can we afford to indulge ourselves with this whole elaborate food system that it takes to produce animal proteins? Can we afford that? And do we have the right? Do we deserve that? While other countries in the world, you know, have nowhere near that kind of food production system. So do we deserve it? And it takes a great amount of energy and resources to perpetuate the kind of food system that we have in this country. And that is really being questioned by a lot of people. This book also points out that what is not only dreadful about, in addition to being the dreadfulness of the suffering of the animals that occurs in our food production system in this country, is that man himself surpasses unnecessarily the highest spiritual capacity, or man suppresses the highest spiritual capacity, which is that of being able to have sympathy and compassion toward other living creatures beside himself. And by violating that ability to have a more compassionate attitude toward other creatures, it actually makes the human, it's him or herself, more cruel and more detached from the other aspects of creation. So this is a little bit shocking, but I'd like to share it anyway, and I have to admit, I mean, when I read it, it was a little bit shocking too, but it's food for thought, and please, you know, don't take it, I mean, you know, however you react to it, please be honest about that and share it if you have any responses. But I thought it really portrayed this whole question of the ethics of food, the food system in our country. I think it portrays it very clearly. Old MacDonald had a farm, and on this farm he had 800,000 laying hens, 4 to a 12 by 18 inch cage, stacked and lined up row after row, with beaks removed, defecating on the caged hens below, living in artificial daylight to maximize their egg production, to the point where they no longer are productive and then they are slaughtered, or till they collapse from soft bones due to mineral depletion from making eggs. Old MacDonald had a farm, and on this farm he had female pigs, isolated in narrow stalls or tied down for as long as 5 years, consequently suffering from obesity and arthritis, all so that they won't fight among themselves in the forced, overcrowded pens. Old MacDonald had a farm, and on this farm he had veal calves raised in total confinement, often in total darkness, purposely fed an iron-deficient diet to give their meat its light color. Old MacDonald had a farm, and on this farm he had a sterile automated building designed with artificial day and night slated floors that caused lameness, where animals were treated with hormones and antibiotics whether they needed them or not, in social isolation and no escape. Old MacDonald had a farm, and on this farm he had so many animals that it was impossible, not to mention inefficient, to attend to or even notice when even a few of them were sick and dying, while the majority were maintained. E-I-E-I-O. This first page portrays exactly what is going on in our country's food production right now, the kind of ways that we produce food. And then this couple explains further in more detail the way that the veal and the young calves are treated, and in detail the way that the chickens are, their beaks are removed, and all the kinds of things that is done to the chickens and the pigs. And those are just brief synopses, but she goes into much further detail about what an average slaughterhouse in this country is like when you go into it. And they had she had one quote that if all the slaughterhouses in this country were made of glass, the majority of us would be vegetarians after having seen what goes on. So again, this is an approach which I myself have not embraced, or I wasn't really, you know, very much familiar with, but that I thought was very much a part of the questioning of our diet and of our food stewardship. The exploitation of animals is also used in testing all kinds of luxury items that we have in this country. Animals are tested for, all kinds of products are tested on animals. Dietary, soft drinks, cosmetics, cleaners, NutraSweet kinds of things, all kinds of products that many times are luxury items for us, for our own diet. Our bodies don't really need it. And they are tested on animals, and many times the animals undergo a lot of pain and suffering. So that kind of all revolves around this ethical question of diet. Do you have anything to add to that? The environmental stuff. So does anyone have any comments or any reactions to that one or questions? Yes.
I think I could go over those figures, and from the figures I've heard, I could find a lot of deviation in there.
Really?
Now, when you feed this beef cattle, and this was mentioned, this grass on the hills and so on, mm-hmm. most of this beef, the first half, is raised virtually on roughage, roughage that isn't suitable for any other crop. Okay. The grain is used to finish the animal. And I don't know, the beef farmers, if they have to operate on that basis of 16 pounds to even get a pound of gain at that point, they wouldn't be in the business. They couldn't afford to. So well, I don't know where these figures come from. Mm-hmm. Now you mentioned after that there's still the waste. They shouldn't have, I don't know these figures, if they would be from actual meat after the bone and excess tallow and so on is off. Mm-hmm. It probably would be somewhat closer, mm-hmm. I think, to still to buy. Uh-huh. And then, of course, this is an old thing. I mean, we've heard it around for a long time. I've got a farm background, so I can talk about this.
Yes.
About these sows being kept in those cages. Is that worse than they were out in this wallowing in this mud hole? Then come out and nurse their pigs. Surprisingly, most of these pigs survived, but I don't know. When I've seen these operations, I'm not too sure that the way that most of them are operated are all bad.
It's sure worse for the pigs.
Pardon?
I said, it's sure worse for the pigs to be tied down.
Worse than to be in that mud hole?
Yeah.
They like the mud.
They like the mud.
Yeah, they like
the mud. They like the mud to keep cool. But they're, the pig in the way most of them are raised, and most of the hogs today are going to be raised in confinement. They're raised with ventilation and kept cool. They don't have to be in that mud to keep cool. Also, well, 10% protein in alfalfa is very low protein, but I don't know where you'd ever find people that would eat all the alfalfa that's raised in this country.
Right.
You could feed an awful lot of people.
Right. You could.
If you could get them to eat it.
Exactly. Well, yeah, and I mean, it's actually the same as beans. I mean, people in this country generally don't like to eat beans either, actually.
Yeah, I mean,
and when you work with
low-income,
right, no, nothing wrong with them at all. When I've worked with low-income people, you try to tell them with their food stamps, encourage them to work to buy beans because it's a better protein, and they're just, you know, that's ridiculous. I mean, they want to buy macaroni and cheese and pop and other things that normal people can consume. You know, don't tell me about eating beans. So I mean, beans are also, beans and legumes are really kind of poo-pooed also, and actually they're a very, very good food, but how could we get people to eat more of them? And same with alfalfa and other food sources. So, but I appreciate your comments, and I do, you know, admit that I did take my figures out of Dr. Small Planet, and Frances Moore LePay and her husband, Dr. LePay also, they both have information in the back as to where they got their statistics, but they could be off or they could have changed. This was written, well, I think, in the late 70s.
In principle, this thing is correct. Uh-huh. You could feed an awful lot more people than shooting a grain.
Yeah. But I know it. I mean, all it still needs to be questioned. It's just something to be more aware of and think about. Yeah.
I think your figure on beef cattle, though, when you're thinking about what is waste, it's not just the bone and the hooves and that sort of thing. It's that it took that many pounds of grain, which are essentially wasted, to gain that pound of edible beef. Mm-hmm. That it's not just that the cow itself doesn't yield. I mean, it does yield a lot, and if you used every possible part, you could find some use for a lot of it, but it already consumed all that grain to get to that point.
Yes. Well, if there's no other comments on that, we'll just go ahead and finish up the last two so that then we can have a little bit more focus on diet here and what to do. So if we move into environmental reasons, we can ask the first question, you know, are there limits to the Earth's agricultural production, the agricultural capacity of the Earth, are there limits? Some people will argue that they're not limits. In a lot of ways, there are limits, because we can push the soil to its limits here by using fertilizers and other chemicals to enrich the soil, but given the natural process in other countries that use a more organic way of farming, just from the centuries that they have been farming, it's always that they utilize one plot of land for two or three years at the most, and then they change and they let that land itself regenerate slowly, and they use a different section of land for 3 or 4 years, and they rotate their crops, and then they'll use another section even before they come back to that first section. So the natural rejuvenation of the soil is different with the kind of food production system that we have in this country, because we kind of force it to produce more, and we use all kinds of chemicals and substances to yield a maximum production quantity, but actually we might be surpassing the capacity of the Earth's agricultural, you know, the natural agricultural production. And that I'm not expert enough to be able to explain further on, but the whole question of the capacity, are we reaching maximum capacity, and how much more can we push the Earth's resources even in our own country? And there are examples of places where the Earth's resources have been, you know, pushed to a limit in the California basin and in the central California area, where a lot of irrigation was done, and now they find that although it has produced many crops and many plants for several years, it's actually having a very adverse erosion effect on the land now, and it will no longer be productive. There are also, when we, again, using high amounts of fertilizers and chemicals and additives and not letting the natural cycle, you know, I think those are just environmental questions that people have. Is it right to do that, and what are the consequences of that? Again, like I explained up here, the fact that an acre of cereals can produce 5 times more protein for human consumption than an acre devoted to meat, and legumes 10 times more, leafy vegetables up to 15 times more. What kind of stewardship of the land are we having in this country with the food system that we do have at present, where we spend a lot more of our acreage grazing beef cattle? And then, as I had already pointed out, environmental questions about waste. There was one point in Frances Moore LePay's book where they talk about waste and how even the waste is wasted, that there's so much waste, animal waste, in our food production system that we wouldn't have to deal with, and we wouldn't have to try to dispose of and work with if humans consumed lower on the food chain, and there was just the direct cycle of plant consumption to humans, and then the waste that just our own bodies would produce. So we not only have the waste that our own bodies as humans produce, but all that waste that occurs on down the food chain in order to get the kind of beef proteins that we eat and the animal proteins that we eat. So even the question environmentally of what to do with the waste and how are we dealing with the waste. And from what they said in this book, that a lot of times the waste is not even used, you know, most efficiently. A lot of times the waste is wasted. So environmentally, again, that just has effects, the pollutants and the way that it affects our water system and our land and our soil, and the way that that's all involved in our own food, the food that we eat and the food system that we have, how it affects our bodies, how it affects the environment.
Nutritionally also, some of the grains that are being produced now and yielding much higher than the land ever would produce on its own without all of the chemicals is much less high in nutrient quality, like the protein content of wheat that's yielding 100 bushel the acre with chemicals was much less than back when people were using, say, natural fertilizer like manure or something and only getting 50 bushel to the acre with their wheat crop. So there's a lot of trade-offs there with how good a quality of grain you're going to get when you're pushing the land beyond its ability to produce on its own. And then also, you were talking about our water systems. A lot of groundwater supplies are polluted now. I don't know where you're all from, but I come from Nebraska originally, and there's lots of real serious groundwater contamination right now. That's a real problem, and you know, it's not going to be long, I don't think, before people are having to buy water because for economic reasons, we've pushed our land beyond its use and polluted our water supplies.
With chemicals.
So yeah, so that's kind of another consideration in the whole cycle of, you know.
If everything you're saying is true, wouldn't we all be dying much earlier instead of living so much longer?
Well, I don't even, for me, we don't even have to go to the extreme of death. I mean, the rate of cancer and heart disease and all the sicknesses that we're suffering from is so phenomenal
but
in
one
our
of the
country.
Age groups that's living the longest and expanding the fastest are those people over 100 years old. We've never had people live 100 years old.
There's a lot of new medical means now, too, right, that we never had before that contribute to the longevity of people now.
Unless I'd like to comment that we may be in the area where we haven't been pressing our luck, that kind of a thing could change. I mean, when you get things so overpolluted, mm-hmm, and so full of chemicals, of course, there's even a question about whether, you know, in medical terms, all the things that are done to keep people alive are even all that beneficial. I mean, I guess maybe, you know, if there was medicine to keep me alive and I could have a meaningful life, I guess I'd want to take it. But there is a question of people passing on genetically so much tendencies toward different diseases. In the generations to come, that they could be more and more medicating ourselves to keep ourselves going.
Right. We'll require more and more medication and health,
yeah,
and well, medical needs. We'll have more and more medical needs in order to keep ourselves alive.
I also think the elderly today did not grow up with that food system. Uh-huh. Grew up with a much more natural,
yes,
food system.
Yes. Mm.
Nor do we have any idea what's going to happen 25 million years down the road.
Right. But we are seeing...
It could be a ball that could keep rolling in the world, really.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's probably even a generation farther back than that, because they say that your health is largely predicted, or much of it, by what your mother ate when she carried you.
Mm-hmm.
So if the people who are 100, you know, were born in 1887...
Right.
There's also a lot of stuff that's just showing up in generations now that really wasn't that prevalent before, like hyperactivity and learning disabilities in children, just a lot of stuff that wasn't around years ago when it seemed like things were more pure.
Maybe it was.
No, wait. But this is good. Let's just respect one comment at a time. I'm sorry, ma'am. Yes.
I say maybe it wasn't noticed like it is now. People were not aware of it, but it was around.
Uh-huh.
It's proving by learning disabilities. Mm-hmm.
And hyperactivity?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
And a lot of our young children are people, kids who died very young years ago are living now.
Yeah, that's true.
So we've got more problems with children.
Other comments? Yes.
Most of our parents that grew up on farms, they had relatively high fat diets. Mm-hmm. We ate stews and gravies quite a bit. So I don't know if that's as far as having a healthy diet back 8 years ago. I just want to bring up that comment.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just would like to comment to that.
Our parents worked very hard.
Right, I was going to exactly say that. You know, it really depends too. If a person is eating a high meat consumption and fat consumption diet, but they're working their body and they're doing a lot of physical labor, their muscles and the tissues that require the protein in our bodies, which are primarily the muscles for work, will break that up and will utilize it. But in so many other aspects of our society, when we have more paperwork type jobs for younger and middle-aged people and for older people who are just not as active anymore, you know, it's just inviting trouble to continue to eat that kind of food when your body's not able to burn it up and has no need for it, because then all it does is sit in our bodies literally and just sit there and just plug us up, you know, our arteries and our veins and everything, you know, maybe our digestive system too, but anyway, you know, so that's a really good comment, that the labor and the work that was required to, you know, for that kind of food really utilized, the labor utilized that kind of food.
Yeah, I have my grandpa died at 87 and probably fried his eggs and lard the day before that he died. He was just like, ate like that all the time. So that's a good point.
Yeah. Well, I think it could be recognized too that there are certain individuals who, in spite of poor diet or eating the wrong thing, they still seem to live long.
Oh, definitely.
And there are others who don't, but I mean, that doesn't mean that good diet probably should be observed.
If all the rain was fed or ate, what would happen to all these animals?
Well,
the world would be run over with animals.
Well,
animals.
Yeah, exactly.
They could be grass fed.
Yeah, they could.
And fed.
And it would take longer. And then we would consume less meat, but that's all right because they would produce less. It would take them longer to produce the amount of meat that we would be eating. So I mean, it wouldn't get that extreme, you know. I mean, we're really, in a lot of ways, we're just really pumping our animals in this country to just feed us to maximum capacity because we like meat every day. We're actually, you know, if it was just brought down to a more natural balance, we still wouldn't be run over with animals.
Yeah, and there is more protein in grazed animals or range-grown animals, and fewer calories and less cholesterol and fat in the meat
when they're just grazed on grass.
Yeah, but we've learned to like it fat and tender and all the things that are in our American diet now.
We probably should be eating buffalo instead.
Oh, right, you know, that'd be fun. All right, so lastly, if there's any more comments, we can talk about them again. The last category, though, that I think, you know, again, we need to look at, and there's a lot of questions that I have about it, is the international implications concerning our food and the implications that it has on the international level. The first one that I could share is the amount that each of us consumes. The amount of food and the kinds of food that each of us consumes determines the ultimate price of grain in the world market and our capacity to provide food assistance. So there's, the whole, I like to keep using the word our food production system in this country, because it's not just individuals, you know, it is our individual habits, but it's also a system that we continue to perpetuate that is leaning more toward the consumption of meats and heavier foods in our own country, and also a kind of food system that deters the assistance to other countries in agricultural or direct food aid. and it diverts it into a system where economics are more important, so that money as the profit is the end, and where military and political reasons are more prioritized. So again, as I shared before, nationally we concentrate most of our aid budget on military and political purposes, very little on agricultural development. And I can really, I mean, I worked in Africa for 4 years, almost 4 years before this, and I really saw that very little aid really goes to good agricultural projects. Just very little of it does. It's always these other projects that are dams and other things that can create some money for both the local people and for the country, either our country or other European countries that are involved in the project, but it does very little to actually address the basic human need of food and survival for the people of the country. We in the West also many times acquire oilseed products from third world countries. Peanuts, palm oil, cashews, karité nuts, which are used in the production of chocolate, mostly in Europe, but a lot of times imported to America. And from these third world countries, we take these oilseed products. And if we take, for example, if we say, for example, that 1 million metric tons of these products have more protein in them than we deliver back to the country through grains. So through 1 metric ton of grains, for example. So even the kind of system that we have internationally is that we can import these products and give the country a lot of money for them and pay for our resources, but we are in fact taking the very land that would be nutritionally superior for them to eat and to enrich their diet. And since they can't produce, you know, five times more cashews to make up for the products that we want and what they need to live, and their land still is just producing whatever it can, but we're enticing them with a lot of money, they end up shipping over to us their oilseed products and then end up having to, you know, live on much less in their own diet of those kind of nutritional products. And then when times get rough, we send them over grain, but it doesn't have the same nutritional superiority as the oilseed products that we end up getting from third world countries. So that's a real factor to consider. And then another one is that the U.S. in reality is the leading importer of beef, which I didn't know about either, but we're the leading importer of beef. And although we only import 7% of the consumption of our total consumption as a nation, only 7%, this is nonetheless equivalent to the total yearly intake of much of the poor world, of many of the poor countries in the world. Almost half of this 7% of the beef that we import comes from already protein deficient countries like Costa Rica, Nicaragua, Honduras, and Guatemala. And I know Burger King is a very big, they import a lot of their beef from the region of the Amazon in South America. And there's a lot of controversy, especially a couple years ago when it was first really discovered, there was a lot of controversy about the ways that the fast food chains in this country, McDonald's and Burger King, produce all their beef, because a lot of it does come from the Central and South American area, and that the Amazon forest is actually being continually depleted because of the beef the trees are cut down so that beef can be grazed there, and then that beef imported to our country to perpetuate the fast food chains that we have in this country. So that's real interesting too. And again, like I said, it's only 7% of our total consumption, but that same 7% is the total yearly intake for some of the poor countries in this world. And then land that grows money can't grow food. The last point on the international aspect is that when Western countries offer money for cash crops like cocoa, cotton, coffee, and tobacco, that land can't produce food. So it's the third world countries produce those kind of foods, they get money for them, but land that grows money can't grow food. And then those countries suffer and they still end up having difficulties with feeding all of their population. They still have to end up coming to us for aid then, but actually if their own land was used to feed themselves with just regular food to eat, and not be enticed by growing cash crops for first world countries, then they would have enough, of course, to sustain their own daily lives.
There's also kind of an interesting figure I found, that Americans are spending probably 16 to 18% of their income on their food and nutrition, and third world countries are spending 70 to 80% of their income on food. And when there's shortages, they might be spending all of their income just to get food, and then they're still hungry. So that was kind of an eye opener too.
Well, there's this aspect too that we haven't talked about too much, and that's what's happening to the American farmer. Mm-hmm. In this whole process. Things I've heard about, at least in the current administration, but also perhaps in some others, is that, well, the price of food is getting too high, so we got to do something about the high cost of living. I say nonsense. I mean, we should be glad to be able to pay 20% of our income, or even less, 16%. For food, that's a real bargain. And it's a crying shame that we can't say that farmers ought to get more for their product than what they have been getting. And why complain about these high food prices? Mm-hmm. We have nothing to complain about. But the government too often also has been in on this kind of a promoting higher production of food, so we can have cheaper food, thereby control some of the other ills whereby you try to overproduce the land. And actually, I guess I could also comment on this, that as of now, I mean, food production, at least we could still feed the whole world. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we could. I read statistics also that said that we could actually feed the whole world with what we produce.
Yeah. And here we pay big money to store surpluses or to take land out of production so that we can do that. And now, I think I'm for the land out of production. I think the land needs some rest. I think that's...
Deb, can you share your scripture about overabundance?
You know, one thing I haven't heard you say anything about is the thousands and thousands of acres that we use to produce tobacco, which is one of the worst cancer producing items in the world, and nothing's been said about that.
That's, well, I know, yeah, that I would have definitely included that in some aspect if we went on to all those different areas, because yes, we utilize a lot of our own land for producing the barley and the wheat that we use for alcohol consumption, and we have a major, you know, in a lot of areas of our society we have a lot of alcohol problems, and so I mean that can be questioned, that the amount of tobacco that's used, other crops that we grow that are kind of luxury items, so that those are all involved in it too, but we just didn't touch on all those. Which the one about hoarding our wealth in the abundance.
In Ecclesiastes 5, 10 through 13, he who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves abundance with its income. This too is vanity. When good things increase, those who consume them increase. So what is the advantage to their owners except to look on? The sleep of the working man is pleasant, whether he eats little or much. But the full stomach of a rich man does not allow him to sleep. There is a grievous evil which I have seen under the sun, riches being hoarded by their owner to his hurt.
So I think that says a lot about the situation. And just in closing, and we can continue this if anyone's interested, but just in closing, I guess I would say that although we didn't exactly portray, you know, the very details of the way the whole in kitchen runs and what we do with leftovers and those kind of things and how we try to save and cut corners, I would just like to portray that here at Holden there is an effort that we don't cut meat totally out of the diet, because that's not necessary. We don't have to cut it totally out, but we have just at Holden in the Holden kitchen, it has been a movement for the past maybe 5 or 6 years to eat lower on the food chain, to eat more whole foods that have less preservatives, less chemicals, and less pesticides in them, and to eat foods that we can actually produce here ourselves more, to make our own breads and make our own pastry products, to be selective as to where we buy our dairy products, and to be selective as to where we get our meats, and to support the whole foods, especially bare foods that we can order food from, to support the kinds of distributors in this nearby Seattle and Chelan area that themselves, the distributors themselves, who try to support whole food production and not the typical kind of food production that is most everywhere in the rest of this country.